Let me first read a couple of things relating to Shlomo Zalman Zalman Auerbach. Here's a copy of a letter that is a tshuva that he wrote to Dr. Glick. I assume everyone at this table knows Shimon Glick from the Beersheba Hospital. You must remember him from the New York days. At any event, the question...
You cited him before.
Yeah. So he asked a number of questions. I will concentrate on two. One is the issue of dealing with a terminally ill patient who is in severe pain. Are you allowed to increase the dosage of morphine, even if this might, as a side consequence, possibly have the effect of interfering with the respiratory system and therefore hastening the death of the patient? So, Shichuk Evin Shemakatzer Chayim. This is now Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writing. Ho'il v'yusurim kashim ma'od la'adam v'i efshar l'sov lam v'kamamaram ilmalei ligduha l'chananya mishayel v'chuli, that if they had actually tortured the three heroes in the Book of Daniel, they would have succumbed. Nistaber shetzrichim l'rachem al ha'chole u'lahakel alav et sivlo u'lahashkit b'ma'at et ha'kaivim. ובפרט, וגם אפשר שכאבים חזקים מחלישים ומזיקים לאדם יותר מהתרופות. Conceivable the pain alone is more damaging than the medication. אך אם החולה הוא בהכרה, if the patient is actually conscious, חושבני שצריכים להודיע לו על כך. אם הוא בלב הכי יודע את מצבו. The patient himself should be consulted as to what his choice is. If he knows that he is in a terminally ill case, then he should make the president making the decisions. Ach afilu imeino yodea, mikol mokom matzinam bigmara sanhedrin pedala ramubeis vayin shabarashi shekatava hafto lareacha kamocha lo huzavu yisrael malasot lachavere lechavrehem ela davar sheeino chafetz lasot laatzmo ad kan lashono. The person is commanded not to do unto others anything that he would not like have done unto himself. It can be a presumption that all patients, if you haven't actually consulted him, most patients would prefer to have some pain relief, even if this pain relief is wrong. Since this is a typical view, anan sadi da nichalon. If we are unable to ask the patient's choice in this matter, we can presume that that is his preference. Kumuvan, the kol ze dafka ela ba'oten sha'kavanai ach barak lashkatat ha'kevim. All of this is under the assumption that the entire intent of the medication is to alleviate the pain. The fact that this giving of medication might hasten the death of the patient, it's similar in spirit to the rule in Shabbat of you're allowed to engage in an object, or at least there's no kiyuv for engaging in an object which will have an inevitable consequence, but one which you're not interested in, or in fact does you harm. Kavanati bahaskarat inyan shel psigrei shehu rak al derech hamalitza. He does takes the point to say that this is not meant to be a strict analogy to psigrei shehu nichalei, but that just as an analogy. A figure of speech.
Psigrei in this case is what it will hasten the death.
Right.
But it will get relief from the pain.
While if you're giving him a higher dose of the morphine, it may interfere with his capacity to breathe.
In that sense, how would we consider like these cancer drugs that it's so painful and disturbing and nauseating, but they'll still, people will take it because...
Now that's the person's choice, Rav Moshe said, remember last week.
They'll take it because it might prolong.
All right. In other words, you can't, that is something that is up to the patient. In other words, if the patient... feels that there's some possibility of ultimate cure, and he's willing to undergo extremely painful treatment to take that chance, he has the right to make that chance. But we're dealing here with a case where the patient is terminal, that is, there's no hope for a cure, but the dying is dragging out. So remember, we had this principle last time, that in a case like that, one has to distinguish between, I don't know how to use the word, but one has to distinguish between withdrawing support on the one hand and actively hastening death on the other. And of course, as we mentioned last time, there is no really good clear-cut criterion that we can apply to distinguish between the two. The old criterion, the one that the Rama seems to be using, which is to distinguish between active and passive, between active intervention, which is not allowed, and passive intervention, which is allowed, no longer makes sense when we have so much control over the life prolonging process. There's obviously a difference between pulling the plug on a patient who is in a coma and has no chance of coming out of the coma, none whatsoever, and pulling the plug up from the respiratory machine, to pulling the plug on a polio victim who can live a long, fruitful life but is confined to an iron lung. In the second case, it's clearly murder, and in the first case, it's some kind of removal, withdrawal of an artificial support. But the physical act is exactly the same in both cases. In both cases, you're directly doing something which terminates the life support system. So we can no longer distinguish between active and passive. The distinction has to come from elsewhere. One distinction that we saw that came from elsewhere was the notion of what was a normal physiological process and what was different. But here, while waiting for you, I was reading what Shlomo Zalman Auerbach had to say on the issue of administering pain relief, say morphine, in the case where that may interfere to some extent with the patient's breathing and therefore hasten death. How realistic this is, I don't know. But you know Shimon Glick from Beersheba. No, but at any rate, posed this question to Shlomo Zalman, and what he wrote was that since pain and suffering are very difficult to bear, then from the principle of Ahavta lo eicha kamocha, it would be permissible to administer pain relief, even if one of the possible side effects of the pain relief is the interference with the respiratory system. And I'll start again from the beginning of that paragraph. Kumuvan de kol zed davka ela ba'ofen shakavanah hi achrak lahashkatat hakeivim. It's understood that this is only in a situation where the intent of the doctor is the relief of pain. The fact that this is may have the effect of hastening the death of the patient. That's similar to the laws of Shabbat, where if you engage in one act which has as an inevitable consequence another act which is harmful to you or you're not interested in, then you're not construed as actually having performed the second act. And he says, but he mentions this only as a figure of speech, not as a direct analogy. That there are many things that people engage with which are quite dangerous forms of activity. Since people engage in these activities, a man climbs a tree, a high tree to pull down a coconut, or goes into a mine to work, even though this has a certain amount of risk attached, that we rely on God's protection of fools. Since all patients are ones who demand relief when they're in intense pain and suffering, even though the ones that are conscious may be well aware of the fact that this relief of pain may have a certain danger attached. Shapir lomar davar gam benidan dan. We can say davar zer gam benidan dan. We can apply this same concept in our situation. Utzrichan shapir lahashkit hakeivin. and therefore one should try to give, have a patient pain relief even in a situation where it might possibly have as a consequence. So death v'Hashem yorachem, and may God have mercy. A second question that he deals with that is relevant is one of triage. Dimiyut b'cholim
mesukhanim.
Deciding whom to treat. Kedimiyot b'cholim mesukhanim. Who gets priority in the case of sick patients? Katav ha'prim agadim b'resh simon shim cham ches. Im b'meshveset tzahav, im yesh echad shabadai mesukhan al pi ha'rofim u'kedome. V'zeh safek, if you have two patients, one of whom is definitely in danger, and the other whose danger is more remote, v'rufua achat ein maspeket l'shneihem, and you only have enough medical treatment for one of them, habadai dochet asafek v'kan l'shon. V'lachein tzrichim bi'ikar l'tchashev im godel hasakana, the major consideration should be the degree of danger, v'im hasikuyim l'hatzalah, an estimation of success in treatment. Hitchashvut begil, on the other hand, considerations of age, lo baklal b'cheshbon, is completely irrelevant, cannot be taken into consideration. Ba'ayin b'sof mesechet ha'orayot v'mishnah v'gemara seder shel adifiyot v'inyan hatzala mishevi, v'lachein inyan tzedakah k'dome. The Mishnah in Horayot gives a list of priorities of which people should be redeemed from captivity or saved under other circumstances. Ach hoshvani, in other words, that a Talmid Chacham is more than an Am Aretz, a Kohen Gadol, etc. They have a whole list of priorities, but he says, Ach Hoshivani Shebizmanenu, in our time, Kashem Ma'od Litnaheg Alpi, Lefizet. One cannot apply these rules at all. In other words, he simply wipes this entire Mishnah and Gemara off the books, which is a very reasonable thing to do, without any argumentation. Ulam, on the other hand, he says, "La'avir machshir neshima mechole la'achar shehu b'matzav yoter kash la'acher shehu b'matzav yoter kash." On the other hand, if, for example, you have a single respirator and one patient is already on the respirator, o sheyesh l'sheni yoter sikuyim la'hatzalah, and you want to transfer it to a second patient who is more ill or has a greater chance of survival, musubkani ma'od. I think that this would be extremely problematic. We must consider that it's as if the first patient already has acquired some kind of rights to this treatment. The patient himself certainly, the sick patient has no moral obligation to give the machine that's he's currently using in order to save somebody else's life, even if the other person is more seriously ill or in a greater chance of success. If a doctor has already begun to treat a patient who is in danger, it may be prohibited for the doctor who is already dealing with one patient to stop treating that patient and deal with one another. In other words, in advance, if you have to choose between the two, you choose the one who is for which the ministrations will be more useful, either because the patient is more seriously ill or because the chance of success will be greater. But once having begun with a particular patient, in the case of an emergency, you can't switch.
May you ask the patient, for instance, in the case of the respirator, may you ask the patient to inform him that there's somebody else who has a better chance of success? Or can we remove it from him?
I think that under those circumstances, it could be akin to persuading. So I think that would, in other words, the abstract question of whether a person is allowed to put his life in danger to save someone else, we've discussed many times here, and we said that it's permissible. But in a situation where the doctor is allowed to ask the patient, it will rapidly deteriorate into a case where the doctor is going to try to persuade the patient and I would therefore be very reluctant.
Well, the only alternative, scenario I can think of would be, say, a mother and a child, or a brother and another brother, some consanguinity, some closeness, where one might say, to work on my family member, but that's not the usual.
Could we extrapolate something? If the patient is already terminal, that is, that this respirator will really not save this patient alive, then perhaps it's permissible to use the respirator to save a patient whom you actually can't save. To tell the truth, I can't nail down all the things that I said. These are very difficult questions. And I can't bring firm proofs to all of these things. So he's the Rechad Chag Kasher Asmeach, etc.
When was this written?
This was written in 1976 to Dr. Glick, whom I thought most of us around this table actually know, but I guess not. All right, so the one principle that novel principle that he introduced here was the issue of intent. In general, I would feel that's a bad principle to introduce, namely that it's to try to distinguish between, try to psych out the doctor as to whether he's giving this treatment in order to relieve the pain or to hasten the death of the patient, and the distinction is what the intent of the doctor is. So I wouldn't emphasize that point, but the rule that one is allowed to alleviate pain, even if this might cause some hastening of the death process, is something that we should respect. All, as you can see, again, Shlomo Zalman is not trying to argue these things on the basis of some kind of interior halachic logic, but on the basis of trying to grope for some rules and regulations that we can arrive at. I also have a long letter from Dr. Edelman in response to many of the things that we said and you said, which I will read later, but you have the floor.
Well, unless you want to review some of the questions from last weekend.
No, I will read what some of the high points of what Dr. Edelman has to say later, but let's go over the cases as we have.
I am not quite clear where we left off.
I think we left off with case number 5.
Okay, so let's start with case number 6. 73-year-old man is transferred to your hospital with a long history of hypertension, high blood pressure, and 2 remote MIs. That's 2 previous heart attacks. Patient has unstable angina with anterior ischemia, meaning that the left ventricular wall of the heart is not getting enough blood supply.
You don't have to say, but you can get squeamish.
But there's lack of blood supply to the substantial portion of the pumping chamber of the left ventricle, as viewed by the electrocardiogram. A creatinine of 3 milligrams per cent, which means the kidneys are not functioning well, they are...
What is the normal creatinine level?
1.5 or less.
Mm-hmm.
Some places 1.7 or less, but mm-hmm. It's clearly advanced kidney disease. Moderate chronic lung disease, obstructive pulmonary disease. The echocardiogram, which is a way of judging by sound wave technique, the pumping capacity of the heart reveals depressed left ventricular function. Coronary arteriogram shows diffuse coronary occlusive disease, meaning that the circulation to the heart muscle is very limited, with new 90% of this particular coronary artery, which is one of the main supplying branches, 90% blocked, as narrowed rather compared with the study done 2 years previously. So the patient has very advancing severe
arteriosclerosis
of the blood supply to the heart. The patient refuses the surgical revascularization and consents to angioplasty. So the patient says, no operation for me, and perhaps wisely so, because my kidneys are impaired and my heart function is limited, and I don't know if I'll survive general anesthesia, but if you want to put this little balloon catheter in and dilate the narrowed segment, I'll consent to that. So that's the understanding on which they go ahead.
How dangerous is it? And perhaps wisely. No, no. Except perhaps wisely he's refused to do vascularization.
Because in this situation, with somebody who's had two previous heart attacks, a weak ventricular muscle, so that the pumping even before you start is weak, and advanced disease in many different blood vessels supplying the heart, and on top of that, bad kidneys, it's, you know, I'd say a risk.
The angioplasty, okay. Go through the angioplasty. Is that a...
You haven't heard the question yet.
Wait a minute. I just want to know. I might as well get free medical advice now. is that a long-term solution for this?
It can. An angioplasty involves putting a catheter into the segment of the blood vessel that's narrow, inflating on a balloon under, you know, something like 2 to 3 times atmospheric pressure, so there's tremendous pressure exerted. It essentially squeezes the vessel open.
Okay.
The immediate risk is that, you know, within there are various variations on the technique that involve scraping, but angioplasty per se means just dilating.
But in terms of the maintenance and the repair of the disorder, is it as effective?
It's not quite as reliable, but it's a usually much less risk involved.
Okay, next.
I didn't finish answering your first question. And the potential risk is either early closure or late closure. In the process of opening this up, there's some small risk that a piece of the narrows of the fatty tissue can break off and travel further into the circulation and ultimately damage a portion of the heart muscle that you've been trying to spare.
Okay.
Another risk is that, you know, within 6 hours to 6 weeks, the area you've dilated up can close down again. Then there's a so-called late closure. For 6 months to a year later, you look at this area again under an angiogram and it's back narrowed down all over again.
Okay, so that sort of answers my next question. Would this procedure ever be used as a stopgap on the way to surgery?
Yes, it frequently is. It frequently is. People who've had acute heart attack where there's a blood vessel that's been blocked down completely, they can put this in, open up the vessel, and then proceed on with the surgery. Those are all good questions.
Okay, now let's go. I was just wondering, the probability, in other words, when you said about the refusal of such an operation, is it a 70% survival?
I'd say the risk in that situation would be of the order of 25%.
25%.
Of not getting through.
Of not getting
through. Procedure safely.
The angioplasty?
No, the surgery.
Surgery is worse, yeah.
Okay, but now let's get to the question.
Okay, now the question is, the patient refuses the surgical procedure, consents to angioplasty. During the course of the angioplasty, a left main dissection occurs, meaning in the process of opening up the artery, it breaks open. So, and there's evidence of an acute heart attack, and high blood pressure, a sudden raise in blood pressure is noted in the laboratory. Should the patient undergo emergency heart surgery at this time?
What does CABG stand for?
CABG is coronary artery bypass grafting. That's a technical term
for
the surgery.
Hmm? He's on the table.
Well, that's the problem.
That's the question. That's the question they're raising.
I don't understand. Has there been a break-off, or has the artery...
The vessel's been damaged.
Has there been a break-off of the fat, or has the vessel been...
No, it's a dissection, meaning that
the wall itself was splintered.
And that there's a clot forming that's blocked off the entire...
What happens if you close it?
You don't do it, the patient dies.
Oh, what's the question?
Well, the question is, the patient said he would not consent to surgery. Okay, he said that very clearly to you before you started this.
Yeah, but the presumption was that there was such a risk that he didn't want to take that risk. Once the risk was to death. Okay, now you're going to get a risk, he's going to die. So I don't think it's a moot point what he said. He doesn't want to die.
That's the question they're raising. Now, this is not an absurd question. The way that we deal with it in the day-to-day workings in the hospital is that whenever an angioplasty is done, whenever, whether it be 2 o'clock in the morning or on a Sunday afternoon, the operating room is open. There's a team of nurses and surgeons potentially ready to be summoned with short notice. They're in the building at the time. And every patient going through an angioplasty is made to understand that should things go bad, it might have to resort to surgical correction.
Does he sign something?
He has to sign something in advance. So the signature for the angioplasty essentially counteracts the issues of this. And my little note to myself here is discuss all these with the patient in advance, which is done as a routine matter.
Yeah, let me read what Dr. Edelman has to say on this, because he follows up exactly on what you said. Mm-hmm. Case 6 is a perfect example of the importance of the first issue, preparation. Dissection, tearing of the lining of the blood vessel, is a complication of angioplasty, which until very recently resulted in complete occlusion of the dissected blood vessel and a myocardial infarction if surgery was not performed. As a result, surgeons were, and in complex cases still are, notified that a procedure is to be performed. In the old days, that means yesterday, we did not do angioplasty if there was no operating room immediately available. Unprotected angioplasty, quote, angioplasty without surgical backup is now routinely performed, but it is then clear that surgery is not an option. Innovative technologies, such as the insertion of wire mesh-like devices, can in many cases prevent the need for surgery. But assume that this was not available or did not work. The dilemma in this case is markedly muted had the angioplasty operator and primary care provider discussed what should happen if a dissection occurred with the patient and the family. In our hospital, no one would have proceeded without this discussion and a well-formulated plan. This not only gets people off the hook, in quotation marks, more importantly, it ensures that decisions are made with deliberation and foresight in a rational and logical manner rather than haste and under pressure. So what he is saying is that one of the things that has to be done in this whole circle of ideas is, first of all, try to plan ahead with a large group of people who can actually help in the making of the decision. And in a case like this, where this is something that could have been anticipated, as you say, there was in the old days, which presumably meant last week or yesterday.
Well, even in the current days, because if you try with the wire mesh or with any other technique, you still need a surgical team there.
Right.
Those things don't have any guaranteed success.
Right. So, what he is saying is that at least in the hospital where he works, which I guess is where
it
is.
That's
the same hospital where you work.
No, I work at the
Deaconess. Right. So at the hospital that he works, they insist that these issues, if a patient like this comes in, that these issues be discussed thoroughly in advance so that everybody participates in this. In general, I think that his point, and I think that this is also a very valid point, I'll read more of what he has to say later, I think that his point is that one of the remedies of getting around our problem of the impossibility of formulating clearly defined rules which will be guides to the physician or to the rabbi, whoever's making the decision, is to have enough people involved in the actual decision-making process that there can be some form of consensus and also some form of support, that these issues will be resolved not by formulating care plot rules of procedure, but mechanisms will replace rules, that is, mechanisms of how to deal with these issues broadly.
And the fact that each case is a little bit different.
And each case is a little bit
different. Cardiologic problems and different people.
I have a question. You said a description of two hospitals in the same city, not too far apart, which seem to have very different standards of care in this case.
Okay.
You said your hospital, you won't perform this without a backup.
Yeah.
And here we have another hospital.
Yeah, well, I think.
Isn't that a pretty nice?
No, because his point was that it will be performed without backup. Yeah. If the patient in advance has said absolutely no surgery.
Right, but would you do that at your hospital also? Can patient
No, I'm sorry. We would probably allow that as well. If the patient made clear that under no circumstances would he or she accept surgery, then the surgical team would not be available.
Sounds good. it sounds like the default is very different depending on which side of the street.
Yeah, I think that it is.
So this procedure, it seems
that's not true. No, but here's a patient said, I don't want any surgery.
From what he's writing, I think that Jeremy is correct. He says here, unprotected angioplasty, that is angioplasty without surgical backup, is now routinely performed.
Yeah.
But it is then clear that surgery is not an option.
I'm saying the same thing. The patient makes clear that no surgery can be done.
No, I understand. I don't at all mean to say that it's not clear. I'm just saying it seems like the default. If I walk in, if I'm 78 and in poor health and whatever, and if I just, I'm going to go with whatever the standard of care is in that hospital because I'm not sophisticated enough to make a decision, it just sounded to me like in this very short description that in one hospital and another hospital is a different kind. There's a different.
I got the same impression.
And it just seemed like a big difference. Like, if I didn't know,
sounds
like
different outcomes depending on which hospital. Somewhat of a difference here. And it also, I think that Aviva's question is still relevant. I mean, let's suppose you're having this discussion with this patient, and the patient says, I don't want surgery. And then you say to him, well, look, we're going to go with this angioplasty, but it may, there's a 15%, 20% chance that the blood vessel may burst. Then what do you want? Well, if he then says, I don't want to go through the surgery, you have to ask him why. And are his reasons...
And what he really decided, if he could make the decision at the moment.
Right.
I mean, the question is, a patient in this condition coming in, how rational would he be to discuss this and handle it?
Well, that's a very opportune question. The patient is frightened, the patient may be in pain, the patient is in distress, his whole life has been suddenly disrupted, there may not be a lot of time to make these decisions. And there may not be time to call in the three children from California or Texas or Alaska or wherever they happen to be. If the patient speaks only Russian or Chinese, it gets, then you have to call in the translators, and then you hear a third hand, every translator, no matter how accurate, it's not like a UN translation there, telling you how they hear it, mm-hmm. and that's what you hear. It's every case is has its own complexity.
So how does he sign the paper?
Sometimes he just puts the doctor's name on the line.
It says on the bottom, I think. One or two percent of the angioplasty.
But what would happen? A Cambodian comes into the hospital.
Well, that's a problem.
Right now, you need to do it.
If
what would happen?
Rational,
you don't have a translator around.
It usually is.
What would you do?
When the Cambodian comes into the hospital, anybody coming into the hospital has to sign a universal consent form.
And if he doesn't understand at all?
If he doesn't understand and he's decided that he wants to put himself in the hospital for whatever reason and write the blanket consent, that means ultimately that if he cannot, for whatever reason, be explained the problems with this procedure, the risks involved, everything else, then he's consented in advance to let the doctors use their best judgment. The hope is that the doctors would use their judgment based on their concern for the patient, not in any malevolence.
Mm-hmm. Are there halakhic constraints on the patient who surgery or other intervention is not as threatened as based on the fact that they're not stewards over our own body to the extent that secularists use? In other words, this is an extreme case, you could die, but I mean, supposing there's a less egregious case where it probably would survive, and he says, no, I don't want to.
Well, no. We saw from Rav Moshe's chulas 2 weeks ago that if the patient is in intense pain and suffering, and the prognosis is that he is terminally ill, hayishah, which means the only way of really giving that any meaning is that A, will die of this disease, assuming that there are no other complications would kill him off faster, and that the length of this is a reasonably short amount of time. The patient has a pancreatic cancer or something like that, and the patient wants to refuse those treatments which will only prolong his life but will not cure the disease or alleviate his suffering or even cause more suffering, he has the right to do so. If
the patient can be completely cured and he is simply in a state of depression, which may pertain to the next case that we're going to have on the agenda here, then the halakha doesn't say that a man is absolutely autonomous and has the right to make this decision. In this situation, I think the current practice in the United States deviates from the notion of autonomy as a principle, which is only very recent in medicine. Even in the United States, it's only since the 50s or 60s, is something which doesn't apply absolutely in the halakha. Okay, let's go on to the next case.
Case 7. A 19-year-old woman underwent a second cardiac transplant 6 months ago. That means she's had one transplant of her heart, and then had that one failed, and then 6 months ago a second transplant was done. First transplant was done at age 12 because of end-stage heart failure after multiple heart surgeries for congenital or inborn disease of the heart. And this is a particular combination, but it's a severe one. The second heart transplant was done after the diagnosis of an accelerated graft coronary atherosclerosis, that is, the new heart was put in because the first heart developed hardening of the artery very rapidly. From between age 12 and age 19, the heart became like that of, say, a 70-year-old individual with hardening of the arteries. Was complicated by an episode of severe rejection in the early postoperative period, which is an immune reaction where the body tries to eject or nullify the function of the transplanted organ. The patient has been receiving psychological support throughout. She now comes to you telling you that she's decided she no longer wants to live and has stopped taking all of her immunosuppressive medications. So she stopped taking all the medicines that are aimed at preventing the second heart transplant from being rejected. What do you do? What are your obligations to your patient?
How long after the second heart surgery?
They don't specify. They don't tell you.
Well, what does this mean in terms of pain and suffering to the patient? She comes to telling you that she's decided she no longer wants it. Is this because of pain that this is occurring?
Could be because of pain, could be because of heart failure symptoms, shortness of breath, fluid collection in the legs, abdomen.
Or it could be fear.
Weakness, could be just a general sense of lassitude, not being able to get around to do what she wants.
And is this a temporary phenomenon?
Well,
if she were to continue taking her immunosuppressive medication.
It's
temporary, my question is, this temporary depression,
hard,
which...
It's hard to judge that. I just don't have enough data yet to know how long ago the operation happened, how long she's been...
But there are reasonable chances for moderate recovery, that is, recovery that maybe not for being a basketball player, but living a normal life.
If there weren't chances for recovery, I would assume the doctors involved in how to put in the second heart.
Mm-hmm.
Heart donors are extremely hard to come by. A very objective, nasty sense. They wouldn't want to waste a donor heart on something they didn't feel had a good chance of it being successful.
And she's had two.
This is our second one.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we know friends of ours have a daughter who's more or less in this situation.
The psychological support is important.
Any other?
What is the problem here?
The patient's going. You're the patient's doctor.
Yes.
The patient's been through all this, born with a deformed, congenitally deformed heart and great vessels, had to go through at the age of 12 when most young girls are beginning to blossom and become teenagers and enjoying the rights of getting into womanhood, friends. Starting to get involved with dating, whatever else goes on in teenhood. And this young one had to have a heart transplant and probably spent most of her active time with medicines and doctors and nurses and physical therapists and being confined. And then by the time she gets to be 19, the whole thing is falling apart again and she has to go through a second. So you can see why she needs psychological support and why she'd be depressed.
Yes, but what is the question to the doctor?
To the doctor is, what do? She comes to you saying, I don't want any more of this. I've had enough. My life isn't worth living. I don't want to take these pills anymore. They give me side effects. They give me upset stomach. They turn my skin yellow, whatever. And don't want to be bothered to the medical thing. Essentially, she's telling you she wants to end the life.
Does the doctor just say you need more psychological counseling?
Well, that's the question. What do you do?
Yeah, but do you ever have an option to coerce someone to take medication once they're out of the hospital and on their own? And
you can't.
Right.
You can't. I mean, you can coerce all you want.
Right.
If they don't want to take the medicine,
right.
They don't take the medicine. So, I have a lot of people I don't have to coerce who won't. So, any other... I don't want to reserve the...
Well, I'll read to you what Dr. Edelman says. Why don't you go first?
All right. My feeling is that, as Doug pointed out, we need to lean heavily here on the psychiatrist. The psychiatrist presumably has followed this young woman since she had her first coronary graft, knows what makes her tick, how she feels about things, and knows whether there's something going on in her current life that has gotten her upset, either related to the treatment, the surgery, or meaningless, or unrelated to it. When you're 19 and you've had a second heart, you're taking all kinds of pills, and then a girlfriend calls up and says she doesn't want to talk to you anymore. A boyfriend who's been coming to visit regularly disappears or runs off with the girlfriend. So whatever the issues may be, or the parents decide to split up because the strain of looking after a child like this has broken apart the family, there may be 24 different reasons that I can conjure up why this young woman at this particular time. And so you need to know what those reasons are. So hopefully you've had enough contact with her, enough trust going back and forth, that you can sit down and say to her, you know, Jill, what's going on? Why are you acting this way when you've been such a good group for it all? What's happening? And you consult with the psychiatrist, and you consult with the mother, and the father, and the sister, and the brother. Essentially sound out everybody who knows this young woman, see if you can get any clues as to why this is coming about.
Is there a medical facility that one of the daily patients can monitor?
It's very hard to monitor her unless, number one, the psychiatrist feels that she's so acutely depressed that she needs to be hospitalized for depression. Or number two, the cardiologist or the team who handles the transplant feels that there's some kind of crisis going on, where her blood counts are dropping, where she's going into heart failure, which requires inpatient hospitalization on a cardiac basis. Alternatively, you could get the visiting nurses to go in and see her, but they're strangers to the situation. They don't know her from before. You could get a physical therapist who's worked with her, so that's a friend of the patient, as a friend of the family, to go in and talk with her.
No,
I think you'd have to
psychiatric,
lean...
Psychiatric and psychological care is in the long run, I mean, it takes a while. And
yeah,
if
but if you have
somebody there that, you know, on a practical basis who goes in and force-feeds the person on a daily basis for medication, the psychiatrist will come up with some resolution one way or the other, but that can take...
Sometimes all it takes is for somebody somewhere in that complex to sit down with the patient and spend an hour and have a glass of wine and a bottle of cherry soda.
Yeah, let me read you what Dr. Edelman does, because he says essentially the same thing. He says, ancillary services. Amongst the personal responsibilities a physician has for his patients is the responsibility to enable the patient and family to make use of the best available ancillary services. This not only means access to the latest technology, but the latest in physiological and psychosocial services as well. Transplant patients are followed by teams of healthcare providers that include psychiatrists, psychiatric social workers, counselors, etc. The obligation in case 7 is to help the patient work out these complex issues with all of them, with the patient's family, and in case 8, which we'll come to, with the resources of the assisted living center. The only wrong decision is to make a decision alone. It is irresponsible and ignores the contribution of so-called less prominent individuals. So again, he's making this point that one has to have some mechanism of having various different views impinge on this before a decision is made, and this should not be the sole decision of a doctor deciding who's to live and who's to die, as is the case today in Holland, or a rabbi being called up in the middle of the night and having given a spot decision on a case where he doesn't know the details.
Now, in this type of situation, it may be something is
simple or as complex as the psychiatrist is away on vacation. And she is especially angry that in the face of her having now a second transplant and all this work to the best want, that the psychiatrist had the nerve to go off to Aruba for a or it may be that her older sister had a baby. And here she is at 19, barely with a heart, and the older sister just had a baby. Maybe the birthday. So there are so many different complexities. What you need here is not even a psychiatrist. You need a friend or a family member who can get in and let her head down and talk and cry and scream, you know, and get out whatever it is that's difficult. And it may take a few days of not taking pills before you're straight through it. The best thing here is to just listen to them and to tell her things that they just keep you because it's really not easy. There is a problem, a real problem. Well, that's why somebody on the transplant team has to be in that close rapport.
So you can't coerce. You can't coerce.
The institute, it's really a matter of one-on-one. You know, the patient has to feel that there's somebody on the transplant.